music and talk radio about all things, all genders. This is Intravenous, live on CJSF 90.1 FM, discussing and approaching contemporary gender issues through a feminist lens. Our goal is to educate, engage, and challenge the dominant hegemony.
Good morning, and welcome to Intravenous here on Campus Community Radio, CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University on the Burnaby campus, where we are on the unceded lands of the Kwikwetlem, the Musqueam, the Squamish, and the Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I'm Robin, and I am here to introduce the program content that you will hear today. Similar to last week's program, we've had the great privilege of rebroadcasting an audio file that was recorded by SFU Public Square. This one is the President's Faculty Lecture with Dr. Victoria Thomas that happened February 13th, entitled Transformative Justice, a Revolutionary Praxis for Reducing Anti-Trans Sentiment. President's Faculty Lectures shine a light on the research excellence at Simon Fraser University, and they are hosted by SFU President Joy Johnson. These free public lectures celebrate the cutting-edge research and researchers that engage with communities and mobilize knowledge to make real-world impacts. The bio for Dr. Victoria Thomas speaks to that mandate. She is an assistant professor of media communication and public engagement in the School of Communication. She examines representations of Black, transgender, and gender non-conforming identities in our contemporary moment of anti-trans legislation and media hypervisibility of sexual orientation and gender identity politics. Her first book project, Trans Inclusive Television, Black Television Culture and the Politics of Gender Nonconforming Identities, analyzes representations of Black, transgender, and gender nonconforming individuals in U.S. cable and streaming television programs. We will hear Dr. Thomas's lecture in its entirety today on the program, followed by a few questions from the in-person as well as the online audience, facilitated by SFU President Joy Johnson. Here we go.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining me both online and in person. I look forward to discussing a little bit of my research with you this evening. First of all, I do want to say thank you to the Public Square staff. They have been very helpful as I prepare this lecture. I also want to say thank you to my colleagues in the School of Communication for their support of my research, as well as the Digital Democracies Institute for their support as well. So tonight I will discuss a small component of my research. As I begin this lecture, I want to ask you to suspend your first judgment. Suspending your first judgment provides you the space to connect, imagine, and discover new possibilities for making life livable for trans people of color. So we can kind of start this idea of thinking about visibility for trans people, in particular around 2014. So this was the year that the article was released in the Time magazine in which Laverne Cox is quoted as saying, "It is revolutionary for any trans person to choose to be seen and visible in a world that tells us we should not exist." So this transgender tipping point alluded to an era within America and hopefully the world where we were on the edge of a new civil rights frontier, where we were thinking about inclusion into civil society. However, the transgender tipping point points to civil rights, i.e. state intervention, as the only answer to fixing discrimination and moving forward to a new frontier. This motion kind of takes the power from the majority and puts this in the hands of a very small majority to make social change. And as we know, this transgender tipping point kind of led us into this area of what we call visibility. So 4 years later, we see that Laverne Cox has made it on another cover. And in particular, this cover was for Cosmopolitan South Africa. So we see that these particular individuals are not just seen in America, but they're starting to be globally seen. And this was also the same year that the TV show Pose debuted on cable televisions, which is a show that focuses on the ballroom community in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. And so that was kind of the first time we started to see more than one trans person on TV. And so this kind of led us to this particular moment around 2020, in which we can call the hypervisibility moment. And so we see the proliferation of lots of trans women. And here on this cover of Marie Claire, and as we can see, these are very influential magazines, right? These are magazines that people know globally and see. And so Janet Mock was on this particular cover because 13 years later, her particular story about her being a trans woman came out in Marie Claire. However, that particular story used a lot of transphobic rhetoric. And so she reflects on what it meant for her to be seen at that particular time, as well as where have we gone since that particular moment, right? And so when we think about 2020, we can think about this also being the surge of a lot of the anti-trans bills. So we see this moment of visibility move to this moment of hypervisibility. So here right now we have an image from 2021, Sports Illustrated. This is of Lena Bloom. She happens to be the very first transgender Sports Illustrated model. And this came out in 2021. We also see in 2021, Bazaar magazine, which we know is a very influential fashion magazine, featured some of the women from Pose. And as we can see, all of these are Black trans women. And so this takes us up until 2022, where we have this Vogue cover, which is Vogue British. As we know, that is a huge, huge cover. And we have on this particular cover, Yasmin Finney, who is a Black trans actress in the UK. She is the very first trans actress to be on Doctor Who. And so we see all of these moments of visibility and hypervisibility, in particular with Black trans women. And so part of this understanding of hypervisibility is to kind of understand that it doesn't necessarily equate to something good. Here we have a quote from Aya Simone, who is a Black transgender woman from Detroit. And she talks about hypervisibility doesn't always mean that people are safe. It means that you can also be vulnerable to violence and it makes you a target. So if we think about all of these trans women being on these particular covers, starting in 2014, moving to this moment of hypervisibility in 2020, we can see the connections between some of these anti-trans laws that occurred. And so I just want to make sure we kind of understand that hypervisibility is simply the state of being extremely visible. And in particular, if we think about trans people and if we think about the population, it is a very small population. And this idea of hypervisibility became so prominent that in August 2020, Google Trends Data released a very short film titled Black Trans Lives Matter. And in this particular film, they illustrated what were some of the search terms, what were people looking for in 2020. And some of those search terms were trans women are women, Black trans people killed, and trans activists. And that was also the year that the American Medical Association declared that violence against Black trans women was an epidemic. And so just to kind of get us into thinking about the population, if we look at this particular statistic, we can see the actual amount of trans people who are actually in the U.S. In particular, we can see that the U.S. adult trans population is 1.3 million. And the U.S. population right now is roughly about 300 million. We could also see that the youth population is maybe 300K. So we're talking about a very, very small population that is being hypervisible. And in particular, when we talk about Black trans women, Black trans non-binary identities, we have 0.6% of the population. However, we know that Black trans people, in particular Black trans women, are the majority of the people who are experiencing violence, even though they are a very, very small number of the population. And so reports have shown that Black transgender women and non-binary people are mostly supported by their family and not by public. So you will see a lot of familial support, and I'll talk a little bit about how that pushes back against some of this particular hate. So if we think about moving from this concept of hypervisibility, we move to this concept of backlash. And in particular, we have a quote here from Laverne Cox, who looked back at her Time magazine in 2014, and this is what she says. In 2023, we are at the height of the backlash against transgender visibility. We have more people who are educated about trans folks, but there's also a rigorous misinformation media machine. The backlash is ferocious and it is genocidal. And so, like I said, when we think about this concept of genocidal, we want to remember we are really talking about a very, very small population. So at the particular rate we're going, we're really moving towards this idea of these individuals being extinct if we continue to go at these particular rates. And so the harm of these media messages, even though they may seem like they're showing Black trans women living their best life, Black trans women having opportunities, is that they kind of instruct viewers how to treat trans people. And like I said, these are these particular magazines showcase, like I said, the Black trans people who are living their best life. But we have to think about the Black trans people who are not on these covers, the Black trans people who we will interact with every day. And so in the last decade, we know that trans people have become more and more visible in our media, our school, our political conversations, and our workplaces. And we know that many of the world will not meet trans people, right? So like I said, this is a very small percentage of the population, which means the majority of people will not know a trans person. And so these are the messages and these are the ideologies that they take that teach them how to treat people. And another vein of my research also looks at the ways in which we can think about how television produces these, in particular because Laverne Cox was on television. And if we look at the proliferation of trans women, we're seeing them in television way more than we're seeing them in films. And as we know, television is an everyday practice, and it is something that we watch over and over again. And so a lot of the rise of anti-trans bills occurred in 2020. We were in a pandemic. We were stuck at home. We were watching media, right? And so we can see how consuming that much media contributed to a lot of these people pushing these anti-trans ideologies. And so it's important to understand that the dehumanization of trans people is going to begin with this anti-trans sentiment, right? So we're talking about a hostile political climate combined with cultural marginalization and invisibility. And so when I think about cultural marginalization, that just means the act of treating a person as if they are insignificant or isolating them or disempowering them. And then, like I said, this media hypervisibility in which we're seeing so many Black trans women on our televisions makes us feel as if they're everywhere. And all of this really leads to a lot of the homelessness that we see for Black trans individuals, unemployment. We also see a disproportionate representation of them in our prison systems, incarceration, as well as harassment and violence. And so this particular phenomenon has been coined as trans misogynoir. So this particular term takes from a trans woman who takes it from a Black woman, Moya Bailey, to describe the ways in which experiences of anti-Blackness, cis sexism and misogyny form this unique system of oppression. And as Ashley Marie Preston says, who is a trans writer, she's wrote for the magazine Bazaar, this particular term shows this intersection of misogyny, transphobia, anti-Blackness. And it's not just something that is a social problem, it is built into our systems. And so I'm going to read you a quote from Ashley's story about how this became systemic for her. In 2014, at 19 years old, I left my hometown of Louisville, Kentucky, and I headed for Los Angeles. Moving across the country with no family or social support in place might deter someone else from taking that leap, but the safety net that they perhaps felt they were leaving behind didn't exist for me. What I didn't have the language to characterize trans identity back then, I knew that in Kentucky, exploring any identity outside of the default was everything but safe. I'd soon come to discover that random hate I feared wasn't exclusive to an isolated region of the country, but was actually a symptom of a global ailment. In LA, I settled in quite seamlessly. I found a small apartment, a job in retail, and more important, my tribe. Once I understood that there was an entire international community of people like me, I felt empowered, as if I could take on the world. Yet, after transitioning on the job, I was harassed, bullied, and eventually fired. My gender expression was blamed for the hostile work environment. I lost my apartment and ended up homeless and on the streets of Hollywood. I went to women's shelters for refuge, but my definition of womanhood didn't align with theirs, and I was turned away. Deflated, dejected, and afraid for my safety and well-being, I went to men's shelters for help. For the most part, I was turned away because of my cis passability as a woman. Throughout my time on the streets, a couple of men's shelters opened their doors to me. Both times I was sexually assaulted, once by a security guard and another employee, and again by an overnight staff member. So here we see how those particular systems aligned, right? Her job discrimination, her housing situation, and even these social systems that are set up to help homeless people couldn't help her because there was no way, because a lot of our social systems are structured by gender. And if trans people push against this, and then there are no spaces for them to exist. And so, like she says, all Black trans women truly have is one another, because we've been exiled from every sector of society. So trans misogynoir is an epidemic within an epidemic. Another way to think about how systems fail is to kind of think of hate crime laws in the US. So here we have an image from 2008 that tracks the hate crime laws, and this is prior to the transgender tipping point. So what you'll notice is that at that time there were only 12 states that had laws protecting trans people. And it's important to also look at the idea that there were 5 states that had no hate crimes whatsoever. And so in particular, if we think about the things that were happening to Ashley, and at that time she was living in Detroit, and if we look at where Michigan is, we can see that there was very little help and support for her. And let's jump ahead to 2023, right? So this is after the transgender tipping point. So we have to ask ourselves, what has changed since this transgender tipping point when it comes to these particular laws that kind of show how this system is created to disadvantage? What we do notice is that more states now have civil protections, right? We went from 12 to 22. We also know that one of the states that had no hate crime laws, which was Georgia, which is my home state, now has a hate crime law that was passed in 2020. This particular law was passed because of the death of Ahmaud Arbery, who was a Black man who was basically hunted down by white supremacists and killed. So this was kind of the reason why Georgia decided to pass this law. It wasn't because of trans people, it was because of this particular racial incident that was happening during the epidemic of Black Lives Matter uprisings. I also wanna point to the idea that Pennsylvania previously had a law and now they don't. So we see one state that was there for trans people prior to this tipping point, but now that we've moved to this backlash, we see that Pennsylvania no longer offers these particular protections. And so I'm going to hone in on a couple of case studies of how these particular systems have failed particular individuals. So the first case study is Kamora Stubel. So in July 2018, she was harassed while she was at a gas station. In particular, she was harassed by a Black cisgender man who threatened her with a gun. She described her attack as using homophobic rhetoric in nature, including calling her a man and asking to see her penis. And so after he did this, he pulled out a gun. There was a scuffle. And in the end, she ended up being shot. He was charged with the shooting. He was also charged with, at the time, what Michigan calls an ethic intimidation, which was their hate crime laws. However, in 2020, the Michigan Court of Appeals ruled that transgender people were not included. And so they said that the particular law found that gender only applies to masculine, feminine, and neutral genders. So because she was transgender, this law doesn't apply to her. So that meant that the hate crime charge was overturned. Another case we see is from Kelly Stowe, also in Michigan, also in Detroit. She was murdered in December 2018 at the age of 36. She was, in fact, murdered by a pastor. And so here we're starting to see also the systems of religion come into play to once again fail, right? When we think about churches, we think about places of refugees, we think about places where people can get support. But in particular, she was killed by a pastor who claimed it was self-defense. Turns out that the pastor was a frequent flyer of sex workers, and in particular, trans sex workers, right? His desire for trans individuals kind of led him there. But a lot of the women there says he was known for being aggressive with the women, and he had a reputation for not paying the sex workers he hired, right? So we're also seeing economics come into play in particular in this thing. He was only sentenced to 8 years in prison for murdering Kelly. So when we think about the particular system of either there is no hate crime charge and the person gets away, or they are able to take away the hate crime charge and we see a particular person murder someone and only get 8 years. This is less time than Gypsy Rose got. And she didn't even kill her mother, she just planned it, right? This is also less time than Elizabeth Holmes got. And she just stole money from a bunch of billionaires, right? So we have a system that is once again telling trans people, not only will we make it hard for you to live, but if you die, there are no consequences, right? And let's be honest, with good behavior, he'll probably be out in 5 years, right? Right back on the streets to kind of do the same thing. And so it's important to also note that these particular individuals, like I said, have family support and were loved. So these are not just throwaway individuals. These are people who people deeply care about. And we have a quote here from Kelly's mother, where she says, "I just wanted to hear him admit it. I want to know, did you say a prayer with her before you left her out in the street like trash? After he murdered her, he just dumped her body in the street and she was found around 6 a.m. later that day. And did you at least hold her hand and tell her that you're sorry," right? And in particular, what she wants us to know is that she was cared for, she was loved, right? And so even though these individuals are being murdered like they don't matter, they have family and they matter to their family, which is why it's important for us to think about the ways in which we are either contributing to this violence or we are preventing this particular violence. Also, Kelly has support from her grandmother. Right, her grandmother told her to be the best version of herself that she could be, to own who she was and just live her life and be happy. And so a lot of times when people talk about the trans community, they try to make it seem as if older generations don't get it, as if older generations are the problem. They're not, right? A lot of these trans people have support from immediate family and their extended family. It's really the public spaces that make it hard for them to live. And in particular, Kelly's grandmother points to this anti-trans sentiment around desiring trans people. This idea that trans people are not desirable, that trans people are not loved and cared for, right? So even her grandmother was like, if you're attracted to that population, it's okay. Let's own it, right? And so this brings in the ways in which masculinity also contributes to a lot of the deaths that we see of Black trans women. And so here we are in October 2023, right? And we're starting to see more and more deaths of trans women. All of these deaths and these things happen in 1 month, right? And we know about October is that it is National Coming Out Day in the US, right? So it's a moment in which people are supposed to be okay celebrating who they are. But we see these back-to-back deaths, right? And what's important is that a lot of these deaths are by gun. Right, there's a lot of gun violence that occurs. And we know that the US in particular lacks a lot of gun law. So a lot of the violence that occurred is via guns. And so we know that particular system is also threatening trans women. And so if we look at a decade of visibility, we can see how these particular numbers are increasing, right? So if we think about 2015, we can see that out of the 21 murder, 14 of them were Black trans women. We think about 2016, 10 out of 23 transgender individuals. So Black trans women make up the majority of the deaths. And like I said, if we think about 2020 in particular, which shows the ways in which this anti-sentiment came to pass, it doesn't make sense that in a year when most of the world was locked down, that we had 44 trans people murdered and 23 of them were Black, right? So even in times where there is no interaction, Black trans people are still being murdered. And these rates are just getting worse and worse, right? These are not things that are getting better, but these are things that are getting worse. And like I said, if the court systems are not going to punish these individuals, if the court systems are not going to pass laws that protect these individuals, then we're going to see more and more of these numbers a decade from now. And so the fatal consequences of transmarginal leads us to really think about this concept of transformative justice. In particular, this is a concept that came from Mia Mingus in 2019, in which she really thinks about how we can transform these societal conditions. And in particular, she describes the idea that these are not things we can do with the current systems. These are not things that we can do. I can't go to a court system and say, fix this law. Because even if the law is fixed, it could change, right? A lot of these laws are in flux. They're never permanent. Things can be okay one day and things are not okay the next. And so it's not really going to make sense for us to put all of our faith into these particular systems. And so we have to build alternatives to these current systems. And we have to think about how can we break this generational violence. And community becomes hugely important for that particular thing. And so when we think about transformative justice, it doesn't rely on interventions from the state. Like I said, the state has proven time and time again that they don't have the resources or they don't have the actual power to affect real change in the lives. They only have the power to affect civil changes. And like I said, civil laws aren't gonna make it safer for trans as much as teaching and having individuals do better with our community. And a good example of this is recently there was a case that happened in October 22 with Daria Bloodworth, who left Colorado and fled to Canada and applied for refugee status as a trans woman. She was afraid of the gun laws and she was afraid of a lot of the anti-trans legislation. She was granted a refugee status, but it was overturned by the Minister of Citizenship because he said that she failed to identify any gaps in Colorado's laws, which include state level laws to protect transgender individuals. So here we have even a Canada court saying there are laws to protect you. There is a system. And so if you can't access this system properly, then we can't help you. Even though we know, even if they did access the system properly, it still wouldn't help. She appealed, but the appellate judge agreed and said that she did not demonstrate with clear and convincing evidence that she exhausted the course of action reasonably available to her without success. So she has been since deported back to the US. So here we see two systems that are not helping. And so we have another failure for trans people to seek asylum outside of their home. And like I said, this is a decision that is made by a very small few, right? A judge is interpreting a law, politicians are interpreting a law, but they can only work within the system that they are given, right? The only way to fix this is to work outside that particular system. And so one of the organizations that does a really good job of thinking through ways in which we can move beyond the systems and think about transformative justice is the Trans Women of Color Collective. It's an organization that started in DC by Black transgender women who create economic opportunities and affirming spaces for trans women. They have food pantries in Detroit. They have safe houses in DC, Missouri, and Jamaica. So they're creating a lot of these community spaces globally to support trans people. So these ideas of safe houses and these idea of making sure that they have meals and access to computer labs and counseling and mentoring are really what's going to allow them to have more livable lives. Another reason why transformative justice is important is because it does not reinforce or perpetuate violence such as oppressive norms or vigilantism. And we saw the vigilantism that happened when Kamor Stobo was shot, right? The person was policing her gender. He didn't like it, and he decided to act. And the one thing that hypervisibility of Black trans women has done is create this monolithic representation of trans women as hyperfeminine, as cisgender assimilation. Whatever trans women and trans people in general are diverse and are not a monolith. Transgender women can choose to present their gender in a variety of forms that does not negate their womanhood. So a lot of the policing occurs if a person doesn't neatly fit into what you think a man and a woman should do, right? And so we have to push back against these oppressive norms. And we see this evident, honestly, if we think about gender birth reveals. That's just another way to reinforce gender prior to a child being here. Also, this refusal to allow people to access bathrooms and play sports is another ways in which we create this vigilantism, as well as these anti-trans laws being passed that don't allow people to choose their gender, to choose their pronouns, right? These are ways in which we are recreating gender oppressive norms. And these are just not things that are being recreated for trans people, but also being recreated for cis people. We know that there was an incident in Kelowna, BC, in which a 9-year-old child was accosted by a grown man who demanded to see her genitals because he didn't think she should play sports there because she wasn't considered to be a girl. She happened to be cisgender, but as we can see, this vigilantism happens to hurt everybody. And so we have to push past this. And so we know that a lot of Black trans women, because they lose jobs, because they're not hired, live in poverty. So it's important for us to think about how to contribute to this. One of the organizations in BC, Q Community, does a really good job of contributing to the lives of trans people. In particular, they allow you to sponsor fundraising events. So if you know of some particular organization who can sponsor a fundraiser event, this is a great opportunity. They also allow you to donate clothes to individuals. So they have gender affirming clothes, right? A lot of us may get rid of clothes and we may go to Value Village and these other thrift shops. I beg you to give the clothes to these particular organizations, right? Trans people deserve to feel beautiful. They deserve to feel seen the way they want to be seen. And as we know, life is very expensive. The average trans person, Black trans woman, makes about $10,000 a year. That's nothing, right? And so it's important for them to have resources. And so when you participate in organizations such as this, we make sure they actually get what they need versus us passing laws that don't necessarily get to the heart of what they need. So if there are some spring cleaning coming up, please, please, please reach out to Q Community and think about donating any of your clothes or any of your shoes to those individuals. Also, when we think about these responses, we have to think about how can we help them heal. We have to think about accountability, this idea of resilience, and this idea of safety. And so what that means is that we have to protect Black trans women. We have to trust Black trans women. A lot of Black trans women's word is not taken. A lot of times when they put out that they've been harassed, that they are going through these things, nobody takes them seriously, right? But we have to learn how to trust trans people and to trust that they know what they're talking about when it comes to them and to their bodies and to what they need. And we also, like I said, have to support them by making sure we are building spaces that allow them to thrive. And so we have to ask ourselves, how am I contributing to the harm of Black trans folks? Because you're either part of the problem or part of the solution. Neutrality is not accountability. You cannot be neutral and be accountable for these particular things. And you know, doing research to learn more about this particular topic is important, but contributing directly to Black transgender people is much, much better. And so if we think about what it means to be accountable, make sure you call out transphobic rhetoric. Studies have shown that when it comes to trans people feeling safe, people have stood up for them with family and friends, people who respect or support them, people who use their preferred pronouns and their correct name shows them by calling this particular thing out. Be aware of how systems work, right? So in particular, when the judge made the call that the trans woman had exhausted everything in the United States, that shows a failure to really understand how that system works, right? And so we have to understand how these systems are working to disadvantage. Otherwise, we may assume that trans people are ahead. We may assume that trans people are getting the things they need. But in reality, if we look at the way the systems are working, we can see that they don't actually work for trans people. Also, we have to question our role in the system, right? How are you, like I said, a part of the system? How are you contributing? Part of my way of questioning my role is to make sure that my research talks to actual trans people, right? I've done interviews with Black trans women in Surrey, and I've learned that for them, they have received family support, but they're still not comfortable in public spaces. They don't like riding our transits. They don't feel safe when they're shopping, right? And so this is up to us, because cisgender people are the ones that make them feel unsafe. And we also have to make sure we do something to make an impact, right? Like I said, making sure if you are giving your clothes away, you're giving to these organizations. You are thinking about volunteering for these organizations. These are, like I said, more important than passing laws and talking to politicians, but to make sure individually we are making an impact. And just to close, I just want to say that Black trans lives do matter. And this is a quote from Lena Bloom, who appeared on the Sports Illustrated cover. She says, "I don't know any queer or trans people who are harming people, but I know they are the ones in body bags. I know they are the ones being killed, being murdered. They're the ones in society who are killing themselves." And so solidarity should be informed, intentional, recurring, and a sustainable act of service. It is on cisgender people to make life livable for Black trans women. Thank you.
Well, thank you ever so much. That was, you know, for me, there were so many elements of what you spoke about that really resonated. One, I think I've often assumed that visibility is a good thing. And just to challenge that notion and to think about hypervisibility was really helpful for me. So thank you for that. And I guess the other thing that really stood out for me is the call for accountability and for us to be thinking about how individually, not just fixing the system, but the ways in which we are also all accountable. So before we get into the questions, please join me in thanking our speaker. So Victoria, get comfortable.
I will, I just don't like these sheets.
Exactly. Gather our papers. I could ask a few first questions. I'm really curious about how you got into this research. What's motivated you? What's the story that brought you to do this really important work?
I think for me, I was, you know, we were kind of in the point of the transgender visibility, but then I started noticing that when I was searching for these things, I was seeing a lot of deaths. Then I was like, well, how many people could there be? And then I started to do the math. I was like, wait a minute, this is a very small population, yet all I see is their deaths. And so then I started to ask myself, why is this occurring? Why do we have one of the smallest populations being murdered at a very, very exponential rate compared to others? And so that got me involved in looking at what is contributing and what is creating this, as well as where can I intervene? And so that was important to me to think about, how is this happening? Why is this happening? And what can I do to prevent this from happening? And so then my research kind of took off from there, and I thought maybe I would go somewhere else, but then every year the numbers just kept ticking up and ticking up. And so then I was like, this is a real systemic problem that I need to dive a little bit deeper into to find reasons why and find a way to stop it.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, and it's so compelling also because you are in the School of Communications to also take that media lens to it and to think about how we're perpetuating stereotypes and violence actually through media representations as well. So how long have you been at this work for?
Since 2013.
Wow, yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah, so it's 10 years. And like I said, when I look back on the 10 years, the media representations have grown exponentially. Like I said, my first book project is looking at television shows. So I think there was 29 television shows from 2013 up until 2023 that featured Black trans individuals and non-binary individuals across 400 episodes. Wow. And so, and this is across Canada, the UK, and the US. So I'm trying to figure out across those 400 episodes, these 10 years, what have been the main messages and how have these main messages kind of proliferated a lot of this anti-trans hate?
Interesting. You've been busy,
yes.
I have to say. You've been very, very busy. And even in the last 2 days, you've had a few back-to-back events. I was hearing about the other event that you recently had on trans youth and anti-sexual orientation and gender identity movements. So I'm just wondering, as a researcher, and sharing the work that you're doing, what's that been like for you?
Well, part of my job is to be publicly engaged. So I'm very lucky that part of my job is to make sure that I speak to the public, to make sure that knowledge moves beyond the academy, right? Yeah. And in particular, if I think about Black trans women, very few of them will make it to the academy.
Yeah.
Thinking about living off $10,000, getting to these places. And so my job is to make it to when things do change, that they walk into the academy, mm-hmm. and there's space for them, and that they are treated well, and that they are respected, and that they are deemed to be important knowledge producers of our particular society. And I think the ways in which they take care of each other can teach us a lot about how we can take care of each other as well.
That's fantastic. And I understand you had close to 800 people online for the event the other night on trans youth.
Oh, that's good.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely amazing. Yeah. I mean, it's so important. And have you experienced backlash in the work that you've done? Or what's, I'm just kind of curious about that, because I think we're feeling it, right?
Yes. Like, I would say that when I first started this, the backlash was, this is not important. This is not going to go anywhere. And I was like, no, something's happening. So the idea that trans people weren't important, or that trans people are new, I think that was the backlash. This idea of trying to explain to them that trans people have always been here, trans people are important, was kind of the first. Now I'm starting to see the backlash just being the lack of wanting to actually hear.
Yeah.
The lack of wanting to listen to trans people, right? This idea that because I've either seen politicians talk about trans people, or I've seen trans people on the cover of Sports Illustrated, means that they're taking over the world, and we have to stop them. So the backlash to the hypervisibility, I definitely think has been very, very ferocious, as Laverne Cox said. It's been very genocidal. So I have definitely seen the more and more we have these conversations, the more and more we speak out for trans people, it seems like it's not necessarily getting better. And so that's why I think us moving away from thinking about these systems is very important.
Yeah, no, I really appreciated that point that you made about it being individual responsibility, and to be really thinking a lot about the everyday ways in which we can make a difference and be allies and be supportive of Black trans women. So you made a few suggestions. Are there other ways in which you think, you know, as people leave tonight and think about their roles, other things that we should be thinking about?
So there is a documentary that was released called Kokomo City. It was produced by a Black trans woman, and it features four Black trans women in there from Atlanta, New York. Sadly, one of the Black trans women was murdered before the film came out, so she'll never see what it did and what it could do. So I definitely say look for films that are being produced by trans people so you can actually hear from them. So that is a good film, and that film will be featured at the Social Justice Film Festival next week in Vancouver, if that is something you want to see. But I know you can also get it on probably Apple TV. So by watching that, by paying for it, one, it teaches media companies that these are stories that we care about.
Yeah.
These are stories we want to see. And it increases the exposure to make sure we have trans people not only just in front of the cameras, but also behind the camera.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, I'm already sensing hands are coming up. And there are already questions online. So I'm gonna kind of go back and forth this evening, online, into the audience.
So you've been talking a lot about how sort of media perceptions and hypervisibility has affected the way we've seen trans lives be negotiated in the public space. And I think around the transgender tipping point, social media hadn't sort of fully come roaring into force, and that was a lot more of top-down media depiction. How do you think that internet spaces and internet discourses have intervened and changed the conversation in how this hypervisibility manifests and affects Black trans lives?
So I think we can once again go back to thinking about the pandemic, right? And 2020, so that was a lot, like I said, a rise in, it was just us and our screens. And so if we think about the ways in which social media, in particular, companies are not beholden to some of the same laws, also don't necessarily care about protecting people as much as they care about making profit. We could definitely see like a lot of online spaces have become super toxic. Part of research that I'm working on now with support from the Digital Democracy Institute is looking at hate speech that is being pushed by a particular anti-hate group in America, as well as the ways in which that group has made coalitions with US politicians. And so that's what I mean by the system. If we have these very select few people making these laws and they're collaborating with these hate groups, then we're not going to get there. And so I definitely think the proliferation of social media has contributed more and more to that harm, because people are able to get to trans people, I would say, quicker if they can't meet them in person, right? They're able to either have them doxed, they're able to put out their addresses where they live, they're able to get them fired, right? And so that particular space has also created a lot of hypervisibility in which audience members can create more problems beyond the system. So I definitely think that has increased, and I think we'll see more and more of that as we think through how to make these spaces safer. But I definitely, once again, like I said, that's gonna come down to laws that I don't think are ever going to get at what we need.
We've got a question online. As I said, I'm gonna go back and forth. Hi, Dr. Thomas. Thank you for your talk tonight. I'm curious about of your thoughts on Canadian post-secondary institutions' responsibility, role in countering violence and oppression of Black, transgender, and gender non-conforming persons.
When it comes to thinking about the role of an institution, one thing I try to teach my students is that institutions are run by people, right? So a lot of times people say, well, the media is doing this. No, there are people who are working for the media that are doing this. And so when I think about the role of institutions, I think we have to come back to what is the role of each professor? What is the role of each staff member? What is the role of each administration? We can, like I said, come up with all these policies. We can have all of these particular formats, but in reality, the only way to prevent this is for every single person that works in a system to be aware of how the system works and to do better, and not think that it is the administration's problem or that it is a problem that a system is going to fix, right? We have to think about individually, how am I making this space better? And a lot of that can just come into the ways in which we teach, right? Part of the ways in which I teach, my students read things from trans people, right? One of the articles I had them read is from a disabled trans woman from Vancouver, who's Indigenous, who talks about how she's been let down time and time again by Vancouver systems. So having them understand that they need to hear from that particular individual. And so I think it's up to the people in the institutions to do the work and not expect the institution or some grand body that we don't know of to be passing all these policies that people may or may not follow.
Yeah, it's such a good reminder, I think, to not think of it as the institution, but to think of it as people trying to do work. Yeah, it's fantastic. Scanning, yes, we have a question here.
Thank you for sharing your knowledge. My question is about the position of elderly women who come out later in life, and what role do they play in supporting the younger generations? Because there are also grandmothers group, which I know there is a film where they support the trans woman. I can give you the title. But and then the second question is about Africa. Do you go to any parts of Africa, and is there any solidarity between trans African women and Black women in North America?
So the first question, the first question is about elders. So a lot of my research, I haven't been able to talk to a lot of Black trans elders. One thing that is important to note is because of the disproportionate rates of violence, a lot of Black trans women don't make it past 35. And so that's kind of what the elders look like, right? Of course, there are people who make it, but very few make it past 35. And so they are even lacking elders because the elders aren't making it. And so I think if we push back against this and we're able to stop a lot of this violence, there will be elders for them to provide support. But a lot of these Black trans women only have each other and they're very young, trying to survive a system in which they are being murdered, like I said, at a disproportionate rate. As far as the second question, I haven't necessarily seen too many connections. A lot of my research in particular has been focusing on the North American context, in particular the ways in which Western ideas of gender norms have created this transphobia. So I haven't really focused a lot on that, but some of the trans women I have interviewed who live in Surrey, they have immigrated here from places like Nigeria, and they have talked a little bit about the ways in which being here has been safer, but yet they're still experiencing some problems. Thank you so much for that question.
Yeah, thank you. Online, we have a question. How can we hold media accountable for their role in perpetuating the rising transphobia, further putting Black trans women at risk?
So I think, once again, like when we think about media, we want to remember who are we talking about, right? Who were the people who are writing these stories? Who are the people who are producing these stories? And so some ways to hold them accountable is for us to be a part of that media. One thing I teach my students is that I pray you all are the one who are writing the next TV shows. I pray you are the ones who are going to change the way the news reports about these individuals. So part of what I do as a professor is to hopefully know that the students that I'm teaching are going to be the new writers, are going to be the creators. And also we know a lot of our students now are content creators anyway, yeah, on TikTok. So making sure we take away as much power from mainstream media and continue to put out counter narratives, I think, is the way we hold them accountable, right? It's easy for the media to say trans people are great, but then I could say, well, no, that's not true because these are the things. So I definitely think us pushing more counter narratives and us pushing more, I would say, narratives from trans people, right? We have great people at SFU, like Travers, who's doing research where they are discussing and talking with trans people. And I think that's what we need, more people who are making sure trans voices become the voices you hear when you think about trans people. And that's kind of why my research is focusing on television shows, because the majority of people who write for television shows are cisgender people. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out what are the stories they're writing, what are the things that they're imagining? And if we make those spaces more open, then we have more trans people writing, right? And we know Pose gave that, but that's one show, and that show is over with, and it's probably never gonna come back, right? And so now all of those people who work for Pose don't have jobs, the writers aren't working, and so once again, we see this economic displacement happening.
The other phenomenon was this, was cisgender people playing trans roles as well. I mean, like, what is going on there, right? Unbelievable. Yeah, questions in the audience, anyone? Checking in, because there's more online. Yeah, Stuart.
Thank you, Victoria, that was fantastic. One of the brilliant things you commented on is the way trans violence and hatred is echoed in a culture of vigilantism that's around us today. And I wonder if you can, I want to think about this in a way that is not so filled with sadness and sorrow. And I wonder if that culture of vigilantism, which I think is in our public domain in ways that frightens many of us right now, including in governments, yeah, in states, for instance, that we've seen in Canada in recent weeks. And I wonder if you can share with us a little bit about how younger people are responding to that culture of vigilantism, what they're saying, how they're pushing back against it, how they're feeling it in their lives.
I think in this mediated world we have, the recordings, the whatever, I would say that I want to be hopeful, but I'm also more realistic than idealistic. And so I worry because a lot of these particular images, this policing, right? We have people who will pull a camera out and record you. And so in particular, the hate group that I am tracking, they don't create any individual content. What they do is they find trans people and then they take their content, they post it on their hate page with derogatory words. And so even now, if a trans person decides to post something for trans people to help them out, to make them feel safe, these individuals could find that, these individuals could post it online, these individuals can push it. In particular, there is a trans drag performer here called The Girlfriend Experience. She was on Canada's Drag Race, but she's been even doxxed by Republicans in the States, right? So why do Republicans in the States need to be taking images of Canadians to prove their point? And so I worry that the more and more that they become visible and more that they create this, that it's easy for these huge Republican machines, right-wing conservatives to take their information and make them less safe. And so I think the vigilantism in particular, the idea that regular people will see a trans person and send it into this hate group shows how people are really picking up on, it is my job to tell somebody how to live their life. And if they don't do it right, I'm gonna make sure the entire world knows and that they are humiliated and that they are not feeling as if they even want to post, right? And if we get to a place where trans people stop feeling safe to post, then once again, those narratives are gone and all we're seeing is the hate narratives.
Again, online, thank you so much for taking time to educate the participants. I'm looking forward to sharing what I learned with my elementary school colleagues, which is fantastic. Thank you, Anonymous. Is data on the Canadian trans population as available as US data?
Yes, actually the Canadian data I would say is more accurate. A lot of the data I got are from particular organizations like the Williams Institute that does that tracks data like I do, but the Canadian government actually has trans identity on their census. So there's actual data tracked by the Canadian government about trans people. And like I said, a lot of the numbers I have are from organizations and not the actual government. So yes, you can definitely find statistics on trans people in Canada.
Do you think it's better in Canada?
I mean, we always like to think we're better, but I'm just kind of finding myself, you know.
I would say,
I mean, we don't have as many weapons. I mean, that helps.
That's the thing that I think was really important about the woman from Colorado that wanted safety. It was really about the gun rights.
Yeah.
And the judge ruled that that didn't play a role. And so I think safer as far as violence and death, definitely. But as far as jobs, no. Trans people here are still struggling. They're still not working. They do have access to healthcare, but as we know, that could take a long time. We also know we don't have enough doctors, and I'm sure the doctors we do have are not trained a lot in trans-affirming healthcare. So I don't want to say that things are better as much as I want to say maybe things are less violent.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for listening. That was, again, a lecture made possible for us to broadcast by the folks at SFU Public Square. That was Dr. Victoria Thomas from the School of Communications here speaking about transformative justice in and as it relates to reducing anti-trans sentiment. You can find links to more information online under Intravenous in our program schedule by date. Again, thanks so much for listening and stay tuned for Democracy Now!